Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Scott Belware, freelance software developer and longtime user of Ruby and Rails. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Good to be talking with you again.
Yeah, you've got, you gave me a fantastic outline about what we're going to talk about today, and you're a big fan of the Ruby language, aren't you?
I am indeed.
How long have you been using Ruby? And I know that you also have done .NET, and you've done Node, and you've done all kinds of languages. You've got certainly a pedigree that goes back many years and experience in a number of languages, but there's, you know, you keep coming back to Ruby.
Yeah, you know, it started in 2006 with, there was, you know, I think the rise of Ruby really happened around a bunch of guys who were in Java who had previously been small talk developers who ended up in Java and were in the No Fluff, Just Stuffed series of conferences. And a bunch of us .NET guys at the time went to that event in Austin. It was a traveling roadshow. Went to that event in Austin and just to see what the big hoopla was about, why the Java guys were really getting excited about Ruby. So we kind of went to No Fluff and caught a little bit of the bug.
No Fluff, Just Stuff is a series of conferences. How would I know about that?
Well, if you were in the Java world, I think you'd it would be hard to miss.
Okay.
You know, so the all the big names in Java. I'm not sure if the conference is still being done, but it was, you know, Ted Neuwirth and basically I'm not going to run down the list of the list of celebrity names, but it was all the big guys in the Java world on a roadshow going town to town for several years.
And then within that Java world, you found Ruby.
Yeah, and I think it was always sort of, you know, a thing in the Java world to be a little bit more, you know, the word that finally came out was polyglot, a little bit more inquisitive, and to tinker more with more programming languages, which is, I think, why you get, you know, on the JVM, there's a lot of really successful mainstream languages like Clojure and like Scala that are, you know, here and before that Groovy, these languages have a lot of popularity and a lot of use. And I'm not going to sort of just say as opposed to, you know, the CLR, which has multiple language implementations, but they're not as used in the mainstream. And I think in the Java world, many languages tend to end up more in the mainstream than elsewhere. That's just part of their history. I mean, that's just like, you know, that's not a value judgment. That's just part of the background. It's sort of like,
of course. But Rails kind of, Ruby rather, kind of rose up, and there was a time when dynamic languages were not, you know, the new hotness, and now Ruby and started getting people excited, and the Smalltalk programmers, you know, started exploring Ruby, and .NET people started looking at the aspects of dynamic languages that provided value.
Yeah, and I think it happened at, you know, it was almost, I'm going to say a knee-jerk reaction, but I think it was an organic reaction to what at the time we were think what was often called compiler ceremony or the rigmarole of dealing with static typing when, you know, all you wanted to do was, you know, invoke a method on something that you knew the method was there and didn't want to use generics and casting to get to that outcome. So a little bit less, let's say, rigmarole, but it also, you know, opens up some challenges. You don't get compile time checks and so forth. So you're relying on other mechanisms to make sure your stuff is correct. And it also opens up the opportunity to do dynamic programming or meta programming or dynamic construction, where the ability to create DSLs, which was really well exercised and represented by Ruby on Rails. you know, that possibility opens up to you. So you're able to create APIs that are a little bit more descriptive, a little bit more approachable to new developers, a little bit less overhead in terms of having to use XML to do configuration of transformations like what we do with ORMs, what we do with nHibernate, what we do with Entity Framework in terms of creating a description of a transformation in XML. It's a bit easier when you have DSLs at hand. So we get this popularity of Rails coming up out of this combination of, you know, dynamic programming language that's enjoyable to use, plus the capabilities to produce DSLs. And now we get a really, really simplified development environment that, compared to what we had at the time, really did represent de facto less rigmarole.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I just want to make sure for people who don't necessarily know the acronyms, DSL is a domain-specific language. It's creating a language from another language, a smaller, more domain-specific language. And Ruby is great for that.
Yeah. And really, it's you know, a language. You know, all APIs have their own language. Per se. So it's important to say that we're not actually creating a whole programming language, but just maybe making things in the language that look like declarations that look like they're part of the language, but they're not really part of the language.
Exactly. And that kind of gets us into the kind of the impact that Rails has had on other languages, because Rails is its own kind of DSL. I mean, it's a web framework, but it also has some opinions that it brings from its creator and its core team into Ruby, such that it's almost sometimes impossible to tell where Ruby ends and, you know, where Rails begins with the way that they treated dates and the action, what is it called? The action pack?
Yes. That's the website of Rails. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And people saw that and said, wow, this is like poetry. This is like a haiku. I want my thing to be like Rails.
Oh, I think you might have been, I'm guessing here, but I think you might have been referring to active support.
Active support.
The thing that adds like,
you know, now.
Yeah. Days from to the integer.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Dot,
And the reason that I point that out is that when people go and do their little like elevator speech to present why XYZ is cool, inevitably they come and they show things like that. Like, look how easy it is to say 3 seconds ago, you know?
Right.
And then people say, well, was that Rails? Is that Ruby? Is that whatever? It's meant to codify the
That's
joy.
Been the real challenge. And you know, you don't have that with MVC frameworks that are built on static languages, of course, because it's pretty hard to do. I guess in something like C#, you can use an extension method to do that. But, you know, this has been both a good thing and a bad thing for both Rails and for Ruby. Actually, not for Rails, but for Ruby. Ruby has become indistinguishable from a large part for a lot of its users from Rails and from active support. So I jokingly, occasionally refer to Ruby as Rails script. Which is a way to just to use it's basically not really you're using Ruby because you were using Rails, and if Rails was written in something else, you'd be using that language. It wasn't really the focus wasn't really Ruby, although because of Ruby and because of its capabilities, Rails was able to be created. But we get back to this action active support stuff, and you have like 1.seconds from now. That's an interesting thing to have, but it turns out that, you know, the problems with any architecture that's meant for a smaller scale team, when you want to break it into when you want to get a big team, or you end up with a big team and a big app, and you want to move some of that code away from the core web framework, when you are calling .seconds, .fromnow, or whatever on an integer, and you move that code away from Rails, that method is no longer available to you. Whereas we could have created a class called seconds, or a static class that you can invoke called seconds. We could have had another way to do this without modifying the integer. And that was always, you know, that was always a warning that was being issued. Like, watch out for modifying things that really aren't of your own definition. So we could have done things, I think, in a much more intelligent way. And I don't think it would have been either better or worse, because when you show somebody 1.seconds from now, you know, a developer still has to learn that. They still have to memorize that API. Whether they're memorizing one style of API versus another is sort of comes out in the wash. But, you know, if we could roll back the clock, we might see more staunch advocacy for not modifying existing data types.
Does that mean that, you know, whether or not it was intentional or whether or not it was a bad thing, the idea that there's this architecture, this application Rails that has kind of brought its tendrils into Ruby, it popularizes that architecture and that style of monkey patching that may be fun and interesting and maybe very powerful and representative of what a dynamic language can do, but it also kind of breaks some hard, not quite hard and fast, but certainly some rules that we respected, if not commandments, certainly reasonable guidelines that we've developed over the last several decades.
Yeah, and I think that's what you know, Rails is now, you know, been popularized since 2007. So we're to 2017. We're 10 years in. We can now easily say, we've been able to say for 5 years that we have legacy Rails apps in existence. So This challenge with legacy Rails apps, I think, has to do with some of the things that the framework invites. And I think that's true of every framework that works on this scale is going to invite some shortcutting of the rules, let's say, you know, breaking of the laws, completely and abjectly ignoring, sound fundamentals of software. Yeah. So we do that because this was about the excitement of small startups and being an entrepreneur and getting something into users' hands and doing that as fast as you can. And, you know, the fast feedback stuff that was coming out of Agile, that message was mixing with the Rails and the entrepreneurship and the startup scene at the time. So it was all about, you know, get it into users' hands, not give some consideration to where you're going to be in 2 months. It was really shortcuts, but it was really great to take these shortcuts if you know that they're shortcuts and you know how to unwind them later and you know when you've gone too far with this. And you know, if we use that term from the startup world, the pivot, if you could apply that to a technology and say at this point in time, we need to pivot away from the things we did at the very, very early stages into something that can be more lasting rather than continue down believing that this prototyping methodology, architecture, framework, and language, and software, and all these things that are around prototyping, rather than continuing to pretend that we, I'm going to say, that's a little bit politically charged, but I feel it this way. It's like we end up pretending that we can use these beginning phase tools for the later phases of the business. And that's when people get into trouble. And in the Rails world, people have gone looking for answers. And, you know, many times those answers are another language and another framework. Node.js to a great extent got a lot of early adopters from Rails folks who were just exhausted from working with their Rails code bases. And you get a 2-year-old Rails code base and that can be a really dreary thing. Or a Django code base or an ASP MVC code base over an ORM. It's really about, you know, there's things in all of those frameworks that represent an architectural style that can lead you to some hellish ends.
So are you a fan or not? Because it sounds like you're maybe falling out of love a little bit.
I'm a fan, I think as in principle, in general in life, I'm a fan of things that are good for what they're good for and not taking them outside of that boundary. I think Rails is good for, for an early stage development work. And I think that we need to pivot away from it. So if you're asking if I would still use it, sure. It's a really well battle tested web server or application server. But there's things in there that I simply wouldn't use. I wouldn't use I wouldn't build my entire application around the ORM, because it leads to an architecture that is very hard to move on from. Microservices being the topic of the day now. Going from a, you know, quote, monolith to a service architecture is really not a trivial, you know, a monolith is not a step along the way towards service architecture. It's kind of like they're almost diametrically opposed in what they're doing. So getting from one to the other is really, can be really quite painful.
So that brings us to where you call it the race to microservices, where things are going. We've gone from kind of this big monolith, this monolithic architecture, and now we're starting to move out to a more a smaller microservices architecture, which is itself its own buzzword. And I know that you don't like it when people, you know, conflate microservices with containers and other terms. It seems to be the new hot word that everyone likes to just say because it feels good in their mouth. But maybe it's not the right thing to be saying.
Well, I think it is. You know, it's interesting. My running joke is that I think of microservices as service oriented architecture with the warning labels removed. So, if you can imagine a 1970s cigarette package without the shocking and glaring big black label that says "this will kill you and everybody you know, that's microservices are a way to sell SOA, I think, or have been a way to sell SOA without telling people. And there's some really challenging things that one, you're going to have to learn, and two, that you're going to have to modify in your existing implementation, and it's going to be troublesome in some cases, a travail, and in some cases, it might take years to do. So microservices has two definitions as well. There's one that comes up from web developers who are, I think, largely guessing at what microservices are from what they already know. And then they end up trying to basically recreating, 2000s web services,
Or 1997.
Or 1997. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
1994's RMI.
We're going to really drop the references. I think a lot of what happens is people end up recreating distributed objects. DCOM style, CORBA style distributed objects that require a lot of chatting over the network, introduce a lot of points of failure, have no real recognition of how to contend with such failures. And it's sort of just, dispensing with what was already painfully learned and documented by folks who were smart about SOA and understood SOA in its time. And I think, you know, what the intention of microservices earlier was to say, let's rename this because SOA has become about big vendor tools and monolithic messaging, i.e., you know, Clemens Vasters talks about this in a talk on YouTube from the GoTo conference about, you know, the message bus, the great big message bus, the enterprise bus that was going to be the utility thing that we all plug into, and it was going to make the world happy and rosy because we could just plug in. And, you know, that didn't quite work out. So we're breaking away from the monolithic message bus, but it's really the monolithic anything, the monolithic database, the monolithic bus. When you have the word "the" in there, you know, that's when the yellow flag should start to climb up the flagpole and grab our attention. So microservices in and of itself is not bad, but I mean, there are so many contradictory definitions of microservices in play right now, which was the problem that introducing the term microservice was intended to solve. So yeah, I like microservices. I love it. I love working this way. I've learned a lot over the years from some people who have been very helpful and very influential. And at the same time, we struggle to get work done because we're always bashing our heads against this wall of this existing presumption of microservices as merely putting an HTTP endpoint onto a server, into a Docker container, and, you know, shoving that online and hoping that that's a microservice. And that's really the problem. And it's really, for services, it's all about autonomy. And one side of the microservices world understands the aspect of autonomy and what it means to your design and how to implement it. And the other side doesn't. So that leaves people really grasping for answers. And you're moving up from a Rails monolith to trying to do autonomous services. And if you make the leap in just the slightly wrong direction, you'll end up with something called a distributed monolith, which is, you know, all the pain of the monolith plus all the pain of distributed systems all together, all in the same place. And sometimes people even just say, to hell with microservices, I'm falling back. I want to go back to my monolith. And that actually is a really sensible thing to do if you don't understand autonomous services and service autonomy. The challenge is the 2 years that teams and companies spend making that mistake before they realize that they wish they had never gone down this road to begin with.
So how can we kind of codify or bring all of this together into something for the audience that may be listening, that may be younger, who might be thinking that, you know, they're suddenly listening to the, you know, two old guys wax philosophic about the last 20 years of software. And how do we give them a sense of positivity around microservices? You say that autonomy is important. What are some prescriptive things that we can tell them to make sure that they are doing it right and that they don't catch themselves into, paint themselves into a corner?
Well, the first thing I would, you know, take a step back and start with is you don't have to leave Ruby to do this. We've been building autonomous services. A loose cadre of people that are in this world, in this space, have been doing this in Ruby and every other language for a long time. That's not to say you shouldn't explore new programming languages and expand your mind and your capabilities. That should be a different topic. Mm-hmm. When we get to autonomy, I think we can sort of look at a cardinal rule of service architecture that really puts the pause, presses pause for a lot of people and really makes them think. And it can be a shocking moment. If we just say that, you know, one of the golden rules of service architecture is that you cannot query data from a service. Mm. That just, you know, leads to the sound of, you know, like things just falling on the floor as people just drop everything and stand agape at how could you possibly do anything?
Because then I'm like, what am I allowed to do?
Right, exactly. That's the nature of service architecture. And, if you allow queries into your services, you've basically violated the most fundamental tenets of building a service, which is you tell a service what to do, and you allow it to make its decisions and calculations. And then using some mechanism like PubSub, you can ultimately get your answer back. But it's not really let me go get the data from that service and bring it over here to my service, and then I'll make a decision based on what I find and then take some action based on it. That architecture is fraught with problems, and basically it's just a monolith over HTTP, because it's the same old monolith. It's really the queries. When you find queries going across services, that's where you see you're in the weeds. It's where you might not have an answer for it yet, but that's where you should know you should stop and say, we've got the service boundaries wrong. That word boundary keeps coming up all the time. What is a boundary? And it's definitely not a relational database table. So we get the other word, extract a service, or I want to break out this from the monolith. Those are more yellow flags that go up, because usually what that means is somebody's going to try to take like their product table, and make a service out of it, or their user's table and that's also monolithic, because the product table itself is probably monolithic. And, you know, Udi Dhawan has a really great example of this going back, and sort of cribbing from some of his materials. But he has an example of a product table that has a name and a price and a quantity in stock and an image URL, all the things that you would think would be, you know, really normal to put in a product table, except that, price would only be used in pricing code or pricing scenarios like price book, price optimization. Quantity in stock is only ever used for inventory. The name is used for the catalog. It's like those start to look like not the same table, or shouldn't be in the same table, and they should be distributed, i.e. distributed data or distributed systems. And now we see like the stark difference between what a monolith is and what a service-oriented architecture is, and it really comes around the centralization of the data. That's not the only thing, but this is a good way to see whether you're one foot in the web definition of it, or one foot in the SOA definition of it. If you've got that data centralized, which most applications do, because that's what ORM makes easy, then you're very likely off into the weeds.
That's interesting, because it makes me think about Facebook, because I don't know how the Facebook architecture works. I only know what people have said, but I have heard that they keep the large amount of the social graph in memory at all times across the entire system. It's one giant 65 terabyte
it's not surprising.
Redis database in memory, and that's the best way to do it.
That's the other side of SOA, which is data. If you think of SOA and services as the transactional side, the doing side of things, mm-hmm. and the data side is just, let's just like draw a line in the sand and say data is another consideration. You treat it like a data warehouse. I mean, obviously, we don't necessarily have to have data warehousing technology, but if it's a relational database or Redis in memory, as long as that thing is kept up to date by what is, and I'm sort of trivializing it by saying it this way, but as long as it's kept up to date mm-hmm. by the transactions that are flowing around the system, i.e. there's a pub-sub mechanism, let's say, and there's some events happening. Product was removed from stock. Therefore, that event can also be read by the thing that keeps the Redis database up to date. And we look at that data as view data. It's almost just data for display purposes or for querying purposes. And you end up separating the query side of the system from the transactional side of the system. And that introduces some other complexity. We're trading off complexities. But it also makes the transactional side really rather simple. Cause when you receive a HTTP command into a controller and an MVC framework, a lot of the time what we're trying to figure out to do is what do we do to update the database tables based on the HTTP form data. And in a microservice world, you would simply take that command, figure out what its effects would be in terms of events, and just publish or save the events, and then allow some sort of database aggregator, shaper, to read those events and figure out what it needs to do with its data. And again, this comes back to authority and autonomy, the notion of some node, some service, some compute node will know what to do with an event, but it's the only thing that should be required to know what to do. You shouldn't have to spread this knowledge everywhere, spread the knowledge of the database schema everywhere. And once the database schema changes, all this other stuff has to break or has to change. And you get these teams that are trying to be, microservice teams, but you find out that really they have to make all of their changes to all of their code bases all at one time because they're still coupled to the same monolithic data structures, database structures underneath. And that really sort of like you see in practice, we had teams that want to do microservices and they end up with something, but they're not getting the benefits because they still have the same workflows. Like you can't deploy service A until I update service B because we're both using the same database. And, that's an obvious contradiction of microservices. The other one you're asking for concrete signs. If you're a team and you own a service, have a service or many services, and you can simply turn your service off and it doesn't make the other services fail, then now you're talking about a service architecture. But when we put these queries into place, like service A is going to, some service is going to query the product service for its quantity in stock. Well, if the product service is offline, that request for the quantity in stock is going to get a timeout, which is going to cause the consuming service to time out as well, very likely. And then we'll see cascades of failure throughout the entire system. So if you can turn off one service and many other services fail in cascade, that's very likely a missed target in terms of your target was to get to microservices or service architecture. And you really just didn't make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It gets me thinking about what it's almost like you get analysis paralysis. You brought up so many great points that I could see where one could potentially become overwhelmed by all of this information.
So once you get hit with those, these are really like psychic shock points. These are like putting the electrical cables onto your earlobes and connecting them to, like, it'll be a good shock at first, but you get over it really quickly and it starts to get really exciting because you see real benefits, real advantages to gaining autonomy. Definitely in terms of everything that people have been saying about microservices, working with teams that are more focused, that don't have to deal with changes of other areas of the system, the ability to deploy your services, because if you can turn your service off, for some brief period of time without worrying mm-hmm. about the rest of the services coming crashing down, then you can do continuous deployment fairly readily as well without doing the game of juggling, you know, web servers in and out of load balancers and that kind of thing. Not that that's invalid, but, you know, it would be easier to do that kind of stuff if we didn't have to worry about doing the load balancer dance.
Mm-hmm. So as we kind of wrap up and get towards the end of our podcast here, maybe you could say something about all of this as it relates to event sourcing.
Event sourcing is a natural outflow of having PubSub. So if a service can only receive an instruction, and then based on that instruction, it will broadcast the results of that instruction. So our favorite example is a bank account. Say you send an instruction to an account service component and tell it to withdraw $10. And when it's mm-hmm. done with that withdrawal, it broadcasts, you know, withdrew $10 for account 123. That event can be then picked up, subscribed, processed, listened to, whatever the terminology you want, by anything else that needs to be aware of account balances changing. If you have that style of architecture already, which if you don't, it's going to be very, very, very difficult to achieve a services architecture because you're going to end up tightly coupling things with queries. But so if you have that architecture and you have events, we can just use those events as the application data storage. So instead of updating a relational database row in the example of a bank account, or an inventory slot or whatever you have, knowing mm-hmm. that, you know, a deposit happened, then a withdrawal happened, then a deposit happened, then a withdrawal happened, because these events are being written all the time anyway, we can just use those events to calculate up what the balance of the bank account is. Hmm. Or the fact that the account was opened because there was an account opened account, or the account was closed because there was an account closed account, or that there was a funds transfer because there was a funds transfer event. All of these events that already exist that have to exist because of PubSub can simply be stored into another kind of storage, which is a stream. So rather than just emitting them to messaging infrastructure, they actually get stored to stream data storage, which is sort of another database schema or another database technology, even in some cases, that are really just meant for storing events. So you have an account 123 object, usually would be a row in a database. Now you have an account 123 stream, and every event that has happened to that account gets written to that stream, and you can always know the current state of that account just by gathering up the events and applying them in sequence. And like what you said about Facebook, you know, we end up in this sort of architecture with objects in memory, rather than objects on disk.
All right. Are there any books or any particular places to start other than this very good podcast? Where can someone start to kind of pick this up other than hard won
hard work? I've never had a good answer for that question. And the reason is I picked it up along the way over, you know, numerous years. So mm-hmm. I didn't go through the process of picking it up for a book. So I wish I had a better question for that. And I've actually never seen all of this put into one book. I don't know if it's just hasn't happened yet, or it's such a nuanced thing that it's hard to write about. But I don't know of one. I'll just say that much. I know of people that I've learned from. Ironically, a lot of them in the Microsoft community, like Udi Dahan and Greg Young and Clemens Vasters, very influential and very clear-minded speakers and writers. All of their blogs definitely worthwhile pursuing. And, you know, shameless plug, we're doing some training in event sourcing and distributed systems for the Ruby world in an effort to help people with these monolithic Rails apps to make that mind shift from monolithic development also using service-oriented techniques and libraries, without actually having to, dump the programming language. Not that that's a problem. It's good to learn a new programming language. It's usually a very high risk to learn a new programming language and learn a new architecture all at the same time while doing mm-hmm. the big rewrite. So
How many variables can you
exactly,
change?
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, right? When you learn a new programming language, the first project you do with it is probably going to be the worst. So making it like the most high risk, you know, thing in your business, the big rewrite with all new tech, all new knowledge, no new, you know, none of the old skills reused. Yeah, that can be pretty risky. I mean, you can pull it off. Some people are good enough to do that. But if we can reduce some of those variables, that would be great. And re-leveraging skills that you already have, whether it's Ruby or Python or C Sharp or Java, you can stay within, you know, keep some of that wheelhouse consistent when you're moving to a new architecture. That can be really helpful. There's an ease, a familiarity, a facility, and a capability that you can retain. I know a lot of people are moving to microservice or saying, for some reason, I don't understand why this is, but, you know, we should move to Go. And, there's no real reason to, like, there isn't a microservice programming language. There isn't one that offers more microserviceness or SOA-ness to it. So, and also, like I said, it's a bit of a risk. So we're trying to keep that going. We're trying to keep, you know, the developers who are focused on Ruby, who've got skills and who are facing some very serious challenges with aging monoliths, to learn how to deal with them in situ, before they sort of go off and just, you know, and change all the variables all at the same time, which I'm really hoping is a future for Ruby rather than simply continuing to see Ruby conflated with Rails and see it as Rails script. And once Rails fades away, as it naturally will do, as we move into different kinds of architectures, that we remember that, you know, the programming language is not the framework. And if you know and no one can leverage a language, then continue to do so.
All right.
Which is ironically a contradiction of all of us having left C Sharp and jumping onto Ruby in 2007.
Well, thanks for chatting with me today, Scott.
Thanks you, Scott.
All right, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.